Well, a number of weeks ago, we started a series of programs on this show about opioid addiction. It has become such an epidemic, not only in Kentucky, but especially in Kentucky, that it was it's reached unbelievable proportions. And so over the last few weeks, we have had recovering addicts. We have had people from the places that help those addicts recover from their addiction, two or three of those. We've tried to hit every aspect of this that we can, including first responders. Have had those folks on here. And we kind of conclude that series today, and I wanted to do this from the beginning with our good friend Dr. Ryan Stanton. He's an ER doc and sees this stuff every day. And Dr. Stanton, good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Fine. Have you done this subject of opioids on your TV show?
Yes. We've actually, one of the first episodes of the show featured Leanne Ripito. I did it over a two-month individual segments about her addiction. She was a friend of mine from high school and became addicted, and talks about her path through how she got addicted, the addiction itself, the fallout from it, and then her recovery. And now she's getting close to 11 years out sober now.
Wow, that's great.
And is helping others, her and her twin sister, helping other folks. So, yes, we've done a lot on this because it's such a huge topic. You know, and speaking from a national standpoint, do talks around the country because we are such an epicenter here. A lot of people, especially getting out in the far western parts of the country, don't understand how much of an impact it is in areas like this here, eastern Kentucky, southern Ohio, western parts of West Virginia, actually all of West Virginia, western Virginia, Tennessee. This is really the epicenter for where all of this takes place.
Why?
Well, it's interesting that there was actually a study done, and the amount, really where this started was the change in the way we address pain. That came out in the late 90s, early 2000s, a lot of shift that people have the right to be pain-free and that we need to be more liberal. And a lot of it came from a twisting of a study, which really wasn't a study, that said certain opioids are very low risk for addiction. And basically that was inpatient, closely monitored, minimum dosing, taking off as soon as possible, with a lot of risk stratification of who is at risk for addiction. And that was taken by a drug company, pushed out as opioids are not addicting, so we need to push this out. The government got behind it, CMS, in terms of regulations, hospitals.
What's CMS?
The Center for Medicaid Services,
okay.
Medicare Medicaid Services.
Okay.
And as well as one of the regulating bodies for hospitals saying, we need to do more. We need to treat and we need to be liberal with these medications. And we need to focus on patient satisfaction. And then hospitals said, your patient satisfactions are low. We need to prescribe more pain medications. We need to give out more. And then you throw in there the profits of having a clinic and being able to sell the medications yourself and prescribe them. And so it boiled down to money. And then what happened after that was what we learned is these are very highly addictive, to the point of higher addiction than most things we understand. And an interesting study came out, research that showed that opioid prescribing varies by as much as six times per county throughout the country, with eastern parts of Kentucky being the highest areas. So six times more per patient prescribed than other parts of the country.
Wow.
And the risk factors they found associated with higher amounts of opioid prescriptions are a greater percentage of non-Hispanic white residents, a greater prevalence of diabetes and arthritis, so chronic pain conditions, diabetes with peripheral neuropathy and arthritis with joint pain, micropolitan areas, so non-metro small cities and big towns, and then higher unemployment were the independent factors associated with higher rates of prescribing. Not only what we found in eastern Kentucky because of the need of these chronic pain conditions, but also in areas where the factories and jobs and coal industry were being destroyed, and there was a need for an economic coping strategy, is the term that's used, an economic coping strategy of being able to use these pills as that old-style barter system of sales system of ways to make money and make ends meet. So a lot of things, I mean, you couldn't ask for a perfect storm, that error chain that comes together that it wasn't one thing, but probably 20 things that came together in just the right mix to make a volatile compound that's now exploded on us.
Wow. And then we did a pretty good job of making sure that people weren't getting these pills. A lot of people back then were, you know, doctor shopping and mm-hmm. getting prescriptions from different pharmacies and so on. But the state did a really, really good job of clamping down on that. So who appeared next but the dudes with the illegal stuff? And it's the same drug, right?
Well,
heroin.
It works the same way. So
yeah.
You're talking about opioid or opiate type compounds. So basically anything that's derived in a way either naturally or synthetically from the opium poppy plant, number one cash crop of Afghanistan, as well as very common in Mexico as well. That's where our, and then we also get quite a bit from China, but those are the two and three areas where we get a lot of these. And there was a revolution in that industry. And all of these things work on the same reward dopamine pathway in the brain that allows, that tells your brain that if you do something and accomplish and you feel really good about it, it's the same pathway. It's the thing that's the reward pathway that your body dumps out a chemical that says that away, good job. And
just makes you feel good.
It makes you feel good. And
yeah.
this keys on that. And so whether it is morphine, fentanyl, Dilaudid, or heroin, they're all opioids. They function on that same pathway. And the problem with opioids is that they are their own fuel. It's not like they reach a point and they stay there. What they do to your body is not only reprogram your brain that tells you you have to have it as much as you need oxygen, food, and to care for yourself. It tells you it's that important, but also it makes itself in demand, more and more in demand. It says, today I need one, but tomorrow I need two, and the day after that I'm going to need three, and then four.
And for the same effect.
For this to get to level zero.
Yeah, yeah.
And so if you started with...
Wow.
What would be considered a low medication today, which a lot of people do, what started as the big one was Vicodin. Now, you know, in a couple of years of usage, it's going to be 5, 6, 7 times a day heroin. That's not guaranteed, but that's the way it works with the brain, is it makes its own demand. And then if you try to stop, it has such a tight grip on that person, not only the rewiring of the brain for the addiction, but also when you try to stop, especially at higher doses, it hits you with these severe withdrawal symptoms that just make people, it tortures you both ways. And so what we found is the state has done a lot of things to decrease the prescribing, and the numbers are dropping. They're not dropping as much as they should, but they're still dropping. But the problem is the cat's out of the bag, and most of the addicts we have, many of the addicts we have, are well past the pill prescribing, whether from the financial standpoint or that addiction standpoint, that they're well past that onto other things that are now coming off the street.
Heroin.
Shooting fentanyls.
And the problem there is you don't know what the heck is in there.
Well, your street pharmacist isn't going to give you a list of their ingredients.
Right.
And if you look into this, and the police can tell you this, there's actually a draw to stronger, more potent people who overdose and die. It suggests a stronger product, and thus it actually draws interest. And so it's the closer, the stronger, the more potent pulls people towards it. And so they want to have a couple of people. They want to push it that way. They want it to be stronger. They want yours to be their products to be the strongest that's there on the street, so they get the customers that come in there that need that fix, you know, for that cost. And the issue is, the biggest issue is that variability on the streets. What else is in there? Not only the heroin, but does it have fentanyl? Does it have methadone? Are there other things that are in there that can be dangerous as well? I mean, the number one cause for overdose death up until a couple years ago was methadone, but now that has become fentanyl within these drugs as the number one cause of death because of their potency. And so that's the challenge we have, is that we're fighting this thing that we've created on multiple fronts.
Earl, good morning.
Yeah, we could talk this thing to death, and that's what we have been doing over the last 8 years. Back in the old days, if you used drugs, you were punished, and you went to jail. Then you end up going to prison. But today, people don't go to jail for this. Is there anybody out there who's got a solution to this problem? And a second question after that. Have you heard anyone's got a solution?
Yes, there's actually several solutions that are out there. The problem is it costs money, and nobody's willing to put that, well, very few are willing to put forth the money, and that's in recovery. My friend that I did the show on, Leanne, she said the only thing she learned in jail, when she was in jail, was how to hide it better and different ways to abuse it.
Is that right?
And that's the issue we see. If you think that our prisons and our jails are places where people become sober, then you're very mistaken. I see overdoses coming from jails. I see addicts that have come straight out of jail. And what we have to do in the states, and what we have to grasp as a state, is it's cheaper for me and you and every single one of us to put these people, to put an addict into recovery, inpatient recovery, than it is to jail. Tennessee did their findings that it's $32,000 cheaper to put somebody in inpatient recovery than it is to put them in jail per year. So we can save money by doing what helps. The thing is, that's a quantum shift, and when you talk about money, that's very, very difficult.
Well, we saved our best for last here, and of course, this is not the last time we're going to talk about this problem, because this problem isn't going to go away anytime soon, maybe never, but Dr. Ryan Stanton is with us this morning, and we're talking about opioid addiction. I heard just yesterday, a story on TV last night about opioid addiction. It says 65,000 Americans died last year as a result
from overdoses.
Of overdose. 65,000.
65,000. 2010 is when it passed up car accidents for the number one cause of injury or accidental associated death. So, actually, now under age 45, you know, as an adult under 45, it's your most likely cause of death for many, for the majority of the population is overdose now.
Is this a USA problem, or does this extend beyond our country?
Interestingly, it very much is. I mean, it's starting to spill over into other what we consider the first world countries, developed Western countries, but it is mainly a U.S. problem. 2008. 80% of the entire world's opioids were consumed by the United States.
How much?
80%.
Oh, gee.
And considering we're actually a very small percent of the U.S. the world population, and 99% of the world's supply of hydrocodone was taken up here in the United States. And what is amazing about this is with over in the last 15 to 20 years, if you look at the United States, even though we've had this huge spike in opioids, our complaints, our perception of pain has actually gone up. We are in more pain now than we were before, and yet we have 60,000 people dying every year, 2 million people addicted. And so, you know, we talked about this during the break. The issue about this is that we have we've basically gone against evidence-based medicine. Maybe we were duped a little bit. But we've gone against evidence-based medicine for the easy button to do something that will temporarily manage or help with pain, and that's where it needs to be. We still need to be able to have it for that acute and severely painful post-operative pain, cancer-related pain. But at the same time, we need to be able to make sure that we preserve that and understand that these are not long-term treatments. These are not chronic related pain. It's not the best stuff. We need to find those treatments that the evidence shows, based on research, based on studies, based on looking at thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of patients, what the best and most effective and safest treatments are for these patients. And there's a lot to be developed and look forward to in terms of what else can we do.
But now, didn't the general legislature pass a law saying that for stuff like, you know, basic stuff, dental treatments and that kind of thing, you can only give 3 days of those now?
Yeah, that it is restricted to 3 days, but there's so many outs. Basically, if the provider, physician, whoever thinks that it needs more than that. So say you come in and you've broken your ankle on a Friday, and I think there's no way you're going to get in to see a doctor in time. We can do longer. We just have to document it better or more effectively in the chart. What this does, though, is it helps us focus a little bit more on it, but also as a trail later. If something happens, a doctor's patients have consistently had issues, can we go back and find, oh, there's a pattern. This doctor is always prescribing 10, 15 days. But what we do know is the longer of a course that we write, even if it's for acute pain, the higher that risk of addiction. So an emergency medicine study came out that found that of opioid naive, meaning they've never had any opioids. They come to the ER for a painful condition, broken bone, kidney stone, whatever. If we write them a prescription, no matter how long it is, if we write them a prescription, that basically 1 in 8 to 1 in 10 will go on to have to use more opioids later that year.
Wow.
And a similar number,
startling.
If we do a 15-day supply, a similar number will go on to be addicts or dependent on those opioids. So they are very addictive, and we have to be great stewards of this, or we'll produce more addicts down the road.
This is Sharon. Good morning, Sharon. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. I have witnessed this in my own home, not necessarily the opioids, but the behavioral pills. Mm-hmm. We took a boy in when he was 17 when his stepfather threw him out. And when he showed up, he had 4 different prescriptions, and on top of that, a sleeping pill, because they said he was bipolar, schizophrenic, manic depressive, you name it, he was diagnosed with it. He took all this medicine, and it turned him into a zombie. So he was with us 2 weeks, and I walked past his bathroom, and all those bottles were turned upside down. He had thrown all the pills out. And I said to him, "What did you do?" And he said, "There's nothing wrong with me." And there wasn't. He was abused by his stepfather. And rather than deal with the abuse in the home, they sedated him so that he'd just sit quietly. And then my daughter lost her best friend when she was 16. He was the kid wearing the headphones crossing Harrodsburg Road.
Yeah.
And she was such a mess. She kept saying, "Take me to the doctor, take me to the doctor. I want to know if what I'm feeling is normal." So I did. And the first thing out of his mouth was, "Do you want me to prescribe something for her?" Now, death is a natural form of life, and there are ways that you handle it. But these kids only know take pills.
Well, and I think that's our culture. Our culture is very prescription-driven, and our country uses prescriptions more than anyone in the world. And I do think that that's, again, I hate to overuse the term, but the easy button. When you come in and our doctors and nurse practitioners and physician's assistants are being pressured to see more and to satisfy people and to keep them happy, Americans want a script. They want to have that piece of paper in their hand that says something productive happened today. And so I'll write people for a prescription for their Tylenol or their ibuprofen. Sometimes insurance actually helps cover it. But it's that tangible thing in hand. But also, I think we are doing a disservice to our children because we're so fast to label them with a problem. We feel like everyone has a problem, when in fact, a lot of it is just natural. I mean, and a lot of it's just kids are variable, and adults are variable at that as well. And sometimes it takes a little bit of being different and changing our approach to these children. But, you know, on occasion, there is an issue that needs to be addressed. But as a consumer out there, I think one of the most important things you can do is when you go to see your doctor or your provider, that you let them know you're not looking for a prescription. You're looking for help and answers and information. Because I think so much of that, we have been trained over the years to default towards you want a prescription.
And I'll write you one to make you happy.
And we'll write you one to make you happy. And I think that's a wonderful thing. If you step forward and say, "I don't want a prescription, we want help."
As I say, we're not going to not talk about this again, but we have really done a lot of shows on the subject. So for a while, we probably will lay off unless there's some big news that comes on in the meantime. But we have had some wonderful guests on the subject of opioid addiction, and it's such a huge problem in the United States as well as other places. But as Dr. Stanton just told you, especially in the United States, Mary is a regular listener of this program, and she is a long-distance runner. And she said, I'm not saying this to be funny. This is not a joke. She said it really is a question. She said, "Do the endorphins that runners get when running go the same pathway, I guess, from the brain, because you get that sort of feeling of well-being? And if so, maybe we should get people running getting off that." And she said, "That sounds like I'm trying to be funny, and I'm not."
No, that's the reward pathway.
Yeah.
And that's the issue with this is, you know, what we don't credit, you know, for these young people at risk is young people, and this was Leanne, when she would in high school would drink some alcohol here and again, smoke some marijuana. And it's still that reward pathway and establishes that pathway. And I think people get that reward in different ways. There's different things. But when you have, you know, when it comes to these pain medications, you know, not only do they temporarily mask the pain, but also establishing that reward pathway and laying down that network. So, yes, I mean, there's other things. And that's what we're looking for in terms of treatments in medicine now, or what are the things we can do that are going to get some benefit, you know, not in thinking outside the box of traditional treatments. It's not necessarily a prescription. Is it exercise? Is it yoga? Is it meditation? Is it acupuncture? Are there things out there that we are not pulling into this to say we can do for people? The challenge is we have our whole culture is so brainwashed that we feel like it has to be an opioid. People, when they come to the emergency room, many don't see ibuprofen, naproxen, Tylenol as pain medicines anymore, and they are.
Yeah.
And in fact, with chronic back pain, and back strains, if you injure your back at work today, naproxen is the most effective treatment for that, and it's had been that way for study after study after study.
Is that over the counter?
And that's over the counter.
Wow.
And you add anything else to that, whether it's a muscle relaxer or an opioid-based medication, it does not improve functionality, recovery. In fact, it decreases recovery and functionality, and the only thing it adds is side effects. And yet we still do it. And it would be almost like if you came in to the emergency room with chest pain with a heart attack, and I kept taking out your appendix because that makes you happy, and I think that's what's going to make it better. But in fact, we need to actually focus on the real problem.
Yeah.
And we're not doing that, and we're not going with the best research. And we're trying to shift that way, but the challenge is we're having to retrain the education of our medical workforce, and we're having to retrain our public who sees this is the way that it has to go.
Can you imagine how much money would be made if you could invent a pill that would give you the, whatever you want to call it, the buzz of the opioid without the addiction? If that would be possible, you could make all the money on the earth. So
the problem
they would have already done that a long time ago.
The problem is the fallibility of the human brain that says, oh, that's a reward. I like that. So I want more of that, and I'm going to change your desires to make you want that more. I mean, there was a physician that I worked with, actually it was one of my instructors, and I think I've mentioned this here on the air before. He said, you know, any of us would take a bullet for our kids. I know I would.
At any moment,
if there was any threat, I'm going down.
Right.
And he said, you would take your bullet for your kids. These drugs made me forget my kids.
Wow.
And that is how powerful they are. And the studies they've done with animals with opioids, I know people don't like talking about that, but the studies that were done, the animals died in desire, for the reward of that drug. They gave up food and drink and would die trying to hit this button to get more opioids.
Wow. Back to the calls we go. This is Steve. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning. I've been in recovery almost 3 years after a 15-year stint with pain pill addiction after I broke my back. And I tell you, it's the hardest thing I've ever dealt with in my life, and I don't wish it on anybody. I know one of the struggles that we all face looking at these young guys today, because I still sponsor people in the programs. I go back to rehab and teach classes and help as many people as I can. The overwhelming majority seems to suffer from some kind of depression or anxiety. And I'm a big advocate for getting some mental health classes taught early on in high school, maybe even middle school, to let these kids know the signs of depression, how to get treatment for it, coping skills, et cetera. Just say no doesn't work. Threats of jail time doesn't work. There's got to be something else that can work. And maybe that could be part of the solution going forward.
And I have a question to kick back to you. What made you decide that you were done with it, that you wanted to get recovery and actually stick with it?
I was sick and tired of being sick and tired,
and
if that makes any sense to you.
And that's, you know, what I hear and what I see with addicts is we can give information, we can provide some things, but it has to get to that point that the person, and the quote that I have heard that I love to repeat is, when you hit rock bottom is when recovery begins. And that
And rock bottom is different for everybody.
Could be. And unfortunately, right? For thousands across the country, the rock bottom is unfortunately death.
Death, right.
And that's what we have to do, is we have to make sure that we have all of these resources and things and tools available for when that person gets to that point in their life that they say, you know what, I want better. And I completely agree. I think anxiety, depression, comorbid conditions, whether it's diabetes, whether it's arthritis, things like that continue to fuel this and push you back into it. And it's almost like the whole group of bad influences that when you start to try to get help, you know, whether through yourself or with others, and then it's often going to take others as well, that pull you back, that say, hey, come back. This is easy.
Yeah.
I can help you.
It's not just quitting using. You have to go through a complete change of lifestyle. Everything has to change.
And that is the biggest risk locally. I mean, that most addicts is, one, when they come out of recovery, whether this is alcohol or drugs or anything for that matter, is getting back into the environment where you have people that are going to pressure you back into it. So it'd be like an alcoholic saying they could go to a bar and just sit there and drink soda. You have to take yourself out of those situations. You have to take yourself out of those influences, even if it means getting rid of friends or family members that are bad influences that are going to pull you back into that. And the number one risk for overdose-related death is after recovery. After recovery. Not only because your tolerance goes down, but also the drugs that are hitting the street have gotten more potent and stronger. And so many of the near-fatal and fatal overdoses that I've seen have been people that have recently done recovery. And so when you do recovery, when you make that choice, then you have to be that more vigilant, knowing that this thing is going to come back. Once you're an addict, you're always an addict. That wiring is always there, that you have to be vigilant. And even on the worst day, you have to have somebody you can turn to that's going to be a good influence, that's going to help keep you out of it, and is going to keep you from falling back into that culture, because that's when it's going, one of the many times that it has the opportunity to get you.
My sponsor told me early on to buy a good suit. He said, you're going to need it if you stick around, because you're going to either bury a lot of people or we're going to need it to bury you in.
Wow.
Yeah, and that's great. And, you know, and I applaud and I will give all the support to former addicts, sponsors, people that are out there to help each other. And that's what we're trying to establish here in Lexington. We're trying to establish networks, even through the city, understanding that we can't just do it through healthcare and law enforcement. We have to have these groups that are there that you can call, that are going to be non-judgmental, that are going to be willing to say, you're going to be able to say, I'm having a bad day. I'm worried I'm going to do this. I'm having this urge. And somebody's willing to drop everything and say, okay, I'm there for you, and we're going to get through this. Because those 12-step programs, whether it's AA or NA, they say today is the first day of recovery. Every single day is a new day of recovery away from addiction, and you're never cured. And you can talk to anybody who's been through these programs, and you have to stay vigilant, and you have to have that support network around you.
Absolutely. That's what you have to stay attached to the program. You know, just because you successfully completed 8 or 9 months of long-term treatment doesn't mean it's over by any means. It's just getting started.
Absolutely.
When you get back on the street.
Hey, Steve, a great call. Thank you.
Yeah, wonderful.
Yes, sir.
Now, something that has become somewhat controversial, this Narcan product that the first responders use to save the lives of those who've overdosed, and it's pretty expensive, and we're paying for it, and it's been suggested that we don't do that anymore. How do you feel about Narcan?
Well, the price has gone up, supply and demand. If you've got only one or two companies making a drug and the demand skyrockets, the price is going to go up with it as well. So basically what you're telling me, if you're saying that you don't want us to support Narcan, that you're okay with people dying.
Right. That's what you're saying.
Because this is life-saving. And maybe, and what I consider it is a bridge to recovery. If I can save your life, maybe that's that point where you change your mind or we can get you into recovery. But what if it's your family member? The people who say that, who say, I don't want to pay for Narcan, I'm okay with people dying, clearly don't have a close family member who's addicted to drugs. Because if you love somebody, you're not okay with doing nothing. You would do anything you could to save their life, even if I said it was a small chance. but you would do anything you could. And that's, we can't go along saying, so why don't we get rid of cancer treatment?
Right,
if you don't
right.
have somebody, yeah. you know, that's, I'm okay with you dying. It'll save a lot of money. So, you know, we can't just pick and choose who we want to let die and who we want to let live just because we don't want to pay for it.
Ray Larson used to say people come to him would come to him all the time saying, oh, I so believe in capital punishment. I push the button. He said, wait till you're faced with being on a jury.
Mm-hmm.
He said those people completely, when they realize the seriousness of the situation, we're talking about somebody's life, change their minds.
Well, people are much more open to pulling the trigger until there's somebody standing in front of it.
Right,
and
exactly.
When you know that face, if you recognize that face and you've lived with them and loved with them, that's completely different. And, you know, I have incredible compassion when I'm sitting there in the room with somebody who's just woken up with Narcan, with what they are going through in terms of their addiction and the struggles that they're dealing with.
This is Al. Good morning, Al.
Hey, Jack and Doc. The question I have is that in certain industries, talking about factories and other work entities, how much training are people going to have? Are they going to have to put people inside of plants to where people might be on drugs, where they don't know it, where they're hiding? Are they going to have to put in the first aid kits, Narcan? Are they going to have someone trained on staff to go and rescue a person? Because it can be concealed in a factory that may have 2,000 or 3,000 people working, or a handful, 100 or 500 people working.
All right, let's get an answer real quick here before we run.
Yeah, I completely agree. Yeah, we're going to have to have it everywhere. The debate now is whether we put Narcan in the schools because of this, because it will impact everywhere. But we have to give recovering addicts a chance to get back to work and do things. But at the same time, I completely agree. It is a difficult situation. We are going to have to think outside the box and do new things with medicine. And in society to deal with this the opioid epidemic, because it is exponentially worse than anything we've ever seen.
Joe, good morning.
Hey, good morning. I've heard that the same companies that are making this Narcan have jacked the price up like 6 times what it was 2 or 3 years ago. So you say it's supply and demand, but I say they're selling you the drugs, getting you addicted. And then they mark the price up on the drug to save you after they've done it. So it's like they're making money either way.
Well, none of the companies that make the Narcan make the opioids as well. Those are both separate. But I completely agree. It is capitalism. And at what point do we say – and it's not actually 2 or 3 times. It's 19 times. Over the last 15 years, it's gone up 19 times its cost. Initially $2, now about $38 to $40 per dose. And – it is capitalism. And then so at what point do we say
you can't do this.
U.S. experiment, this U.S. thing, we need to regulate it and actually bring that in for a cheaper price? I think we just need to get more options.
Got one more call. That's all the time we have. Let's go to Randy. Good morning, Randy.
Good morning. Thank you. Hey, if I had friends or family and even myself that was a detriment to society, I would want myself quarantined. Would you not want that?
Well, it depends on how are we going to define a detriment to the society. I mean, are we going to do that to folks in wheelchairs? Are we going to do that to folks who can't see, can't hear? I mean, we've done that in the past. We've, you know, 100, 150 years ago, we would institutionalize people that were different than us. And, you know, I think at some point, I think we need to give options for people to be in inpatient rehab facilities, so basically what you would consider quarantine, in a safe environment. But we also need to protect the rights, and that is the American experiment, is giving people freedoms for good and bad. And so we have to make sure that we give them those freedoms, but also give them the opportunities to improve themselves.
We've got 30 seconds. Tell us about your TV show.
All right. So coming up beginning of October, we'll have a special on direct primary care and how it may be the future of primary care. But also you can check out all the prior episodes on the Stanton MD page on YouTube, all those segments, including those with Leanne and the opioid segment.
Thank you so much for being with us.
All right, take care.